WMDX Columbus, Madison's home for real news and great conversation. A Civic Media Station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. 9 days until Election Day, Vice President Kamala Harris barnstorming the swing states. Today in Philadelphia, painting a picture of what happens if Donald Trump returns to the Oval Office.
It will be him sitting at that desk, stewing over his enemies list. He is full of grievance.
Former President Trump set to rally today in New York's Madison Square Garden. New York Republican Representative Elise Stefanik says Trump will help the Empire State secure GOP gains in Congress.
It was New York that flipped 5 seats that delivered the House Republican majority. We have made inroads in this state, and President Trump has led that effort. So I think we're going to have some surprises on election night when we see him overperform in New York.
One person has now died, says a hospital in Tel Aviv, with dozens of others reported hurt after a truck slammed into a bus stop near the Israeli city. It is being described as a possible terrorist attack and comes a day after Israel's retaliatory strike on Iran. This is ABC News. A Florida woman convicted of murder for a 2020 incident involving a suitcase.
Sarah Boone initially told detectives she and boyfriend Jorge Torres were drinking and playing hide and seek, and they thought it would be funny if Torres got into a suitcase. She said she fell asleep, and when she woke up, he was unresponsive. But detectives found videos on her phone showing Torres yelling that he couldn't breathe. Boone testified at trial. The two had a history of violent incidents, and she kept Torres in the suitcase for self-defense. Boone could get life in prison when she's sentenced in December. Brian Clark, ABC News.
Delta Airlines taking cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike to court over the massive computer outage this past summer. In the suit filed Friday, Delta says CrowdStrike cut corners and failed to test an update that was sent out to millions of Microsoft computers worldwide. Delta says the outage caused the airline to cancel 7,000 flights over a 5-day period. CrowdStrike releasing a statement saying, in part, Delta's claims are based on disproven misinformation. Dave Packer, ABC News.
It's time to get out the truth about Eric Hovde. Hovde made his money the old-fashioned way. He inherited it. How can he relate or make decisions for us? Now he's the CEO of a billion-dollar bank in California and a huge landlord. With people like Eric Hovde, the rich pay less, and we pay the price. I'm not a political person. I'm a mom. I would never vote for a person like Eric Hovde.
Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together Action. ABWT-Action.org. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
Come to the Lazy Elf Lounge to cheer on the green and gold. Enjoy free Jello shots with every Green Bay touchdown. Stock up on $20 buckets of White Claw and High Noon, $15 assorted buckets of Busch Light, Miller, and Bud products, plus $4 off wing baskets when you dine in. Come for all the fun on game days at the Lazy Elf Lounge, North Stoughton Road in Madison. Follow them on Facebook and find the full menu at LazyElfLounge.com.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Wisconsin has one of the higher closure rates in the U.S. for charter schools. A new report lays out the challenges. Here's Mike Moen.
Charter schools, which receive public funding but are often run by private entities, are billed as alternative learning environments for families who feel they need more options. But the new findings show nationally, more than a quarter of them close by year 5, with rates worsening over time. Wisconsin is among the states with a closure rate of at least 45%. Jenny Hofschulte of the Wisconsin Public Education Network says families enrolled are less scrambling when a charter school abruptly closes.
That's 45% of those families put into a lurch and having to make pivots and new choices for their children.
The report from the National Center for Charter School Accountability cites low enrollment, along with fraud and mismanagement, as the top factors behind the closures. Backers of charters say despite these issues, these schools are sometimes still the best options in underserved areas. Hofschulte acknowledges some families might be happy with their charter school, but as the push to authorize these sites over time ignores the root issues that hinder educational outcomes.
When you look at student outcomes, like, poverty plays the biggest role in it, but we're not talking about how to address poverty in communities. We're saying, like, well, it must be the public school system, so we'll do this other thing. You know, a charter will be better.
The Milwaukee public school system recently dealt with a financial scandal. Hofschulte says that shouldn't be taken lightly, but she suggests those examples are scrutinized more than the shortcomings of charter schools. According to state data, Wisconsin currently has 226 charter schools in operation. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
More news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price for your Sunday sunshine. Highs in the lower 60s, a south wind up to 15 miles per hour, perhaps a little stronger. Tonight, increasing clouds, lows near 40. On Monday, we'll see mostly cloudy skies, breezy, and highs in the upper 60s. Currently 59 degrees.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we will recap the events of the weekend. I'm sure nothing will have happened. And we'll wrap it all up with This Shouldn't Be a Thing. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 11. A voice for Madison, real news and great conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel, and yes, indeed, this is the second hour of our weekend broadcast talking about all things government-related, court-related, rule of justice-related, administration of justice inside our courts and outside our courts as well. Rule of law, an important topic, an important commission for all of us, especially as we go into these final days before the election coming up in 10 days from now, not only of a president, but plainly also of senators and congressmen at the federal level. Many, many other positions up for election in our counties, our cities, our villages, our towns across America, including an awful lot of law enforcement positions and authorities. The importance of understanding voting, not only with respect to those big ticket items that are on the ballots as we go forward and anticipate, if we haven't already voted in early voting on November 5th, not just for those big ticket items at the top of the ballot, but also understanding that law enforcement and the rule of law also on the ballot, as partisan folks often say, it is also on the ballot because the very people you elect to positions like attorney general, like district attorney, like sheriffs, like police chiefs, those kinds of things, if indeed in the particular jurisdiction those are elected as opposed to appointed, all of those kinds of things have an impact upon your lives, the ways in which your communities are safe and secure or not, and the kinds of things that we should anticipate from government, expect from government when it comes to reasonable, rational, and balanced apolitical, nonpartisan law enforcement. That issue, those issues too, very much on the docket, very much on the ballot as we anticipate the election of November of 2024. And so as we think about that, we're also mindful of the fact that the present polls at the top of that ballot, at the top of the list, right now show the two principal candidates, the Democratic candidate Harris, the Republican candidate Trump, virtually tied in the polls. And with respect to those seven states, Wisconsin being among them, also razor-thin changes, razor-thin separations of their support in each one of those states. An awful lot of people saying if anybody tells you today that they know for certain how this election is going to go in 10 days, once all the ballots are counted, don't believe them because nobody knows. Nobody knows. And it is in that context that based upon some of your previous comments and questions sent to me here in Amicus Law Review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, that we talk in this weekend broadcast about two issues, again, that you brought to my attention. One of them is what happens? What happens if the polls are right? And somehow, as we do the calculation under the Electoral College, if both Harris and Trump tie in the Electoral College at 269 votes each, neither one of them reaching the requisite 270 What happens? What does the law say? What does the Constitution say about that? Is there some historical precedent for that? The answer is yes, way back in 1824. We're going to talk about that. And then the other issue that many of you have also articulated some concern about, as we should all be, and that is these statements by Donald Trump, the Republican candidate for the presidency, that if he wins, he is going to be using the Department of Justice, for which he has complete immunity now in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision of July 1. He's going to be using the Department of Justice to jail his rivals, as he has said, and do other things that are contrary not only to the purposes and missions and methods of the Department of Justice, but that also would tend and would accomplish an usurpation of the basic principles by which the Department of Justice has been working on your behalf. We're going to talk about both of those issues. And then also at the end of this, our second hour, some focus upon a group at the center of some of Donald Trump's planning for a second term that you probably haven't heard of. And they're the American First Policy Institute. Among other things, a connection to the rule of law, of course, is that they are advocating for and articulating some of these same principles inside of the policies, the practices inside the Trump campaign, outside the Trump campaign, that have an impact upon the Department of Justice and the way that it does its work. So let us begin. Let us begin first with this question of what happens if Harris and Trump tie in the Electoral College. Well, let's begin with some fundamentals. We know a lot of this before we get into some of the math here and some of the constitutional principles. In the United States, we elect our president and vice president not according to a popular vote. An awful lot of advocacy out there, as you well know, to get rid of the Electoral College. How do you do that? You need a constitutional amendment. How do you do that? Both houses of Congress have got to pass a constitutional amendment. You've got to have the states doing all that. That's also prescribed by the Constitution. That's a big lift. And until that happens, we do not elect presidents by popular vote. We do it by this thing called the Electoral College. To win, and here's the important math, a party's ticket must win the most votes in enough states to attain an outright majority of those electoral votes. And right now, that number, that magic number, we're going to be hearing a lot about that in the next 10 days. We've already heard a lot about it. Certainly on election night, we'll hear a lot about this. 270 votes, that's a number, out of a total of 538 up for grabs. Now, lurking in that overall figure is the possibility, the potential, and let's say it right up front, the potential for a true tie is low. It's minimal, but it could happen. A potential that no candidate wins a majority, that both of them reach 269 votes, electoral college votes, seemingly not in play in 2024. An awful lot of people say it's unlikely, and it is unlikely that will happen. But nonetheless, if in fact there is a tie at 269, we could run into a situation where there is not a decisive winner. And what happens? What happens in the wake of that? Well, let's talk first about some of the scenarios that could reach that 269 plausible, but again, unlikely scenario coming up in just about 10 days or so. Key swing states in ways that would have an implication for that. Again, anything can happen. The voting has begun already, but not yet counted. We don't know for certain. But of the small number of scenarios in some of the forecasts going on right now in which Harris and Trump tie, four of them are perhaps the most plausible. And those are the ones that, again, in this unlikely scenario, each of them would capture states and congressional districts that would tie them. Harris would come up with 225 electoral votes under one of these scenarios. Trump would capture 219. And that would be the base. Those are the states that are presumed up to now to be secure. 225 for Kamala Harris, 219 for Donald Trump. And so that leaves those seven other states. We know what they are: Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and yes, right here in Wisconsin. Those are the so-called seven principal battleground states. Again, we talk a lot about them on a routine basis. Got a number of scenarios, and let's talk about them briefly, and then we'll talk about what the implications would be if there is this tie. Again, one of them involves Trump holding on to North Carolina, flipping Pennsylvania and Michigan. Harris retains Wisconsin, Arizona, Georgia, Nevada. And as a result of that sort of combination, you would reach 269.
The next possibility, the scenario two, if you will, includes mostly the same results, but Kamala Harris and Trump would trade Georgia and North Carolina's identical electoral votes and reach the same 269-269 stalemate. Scenario three, for example. Again, all of this somewhat, if not completely unlikely, but nonetheless, Trump reclaims the Sun Belt states, highly unlikely, and that Nebraska 2nd District, there's been a lot of focus on that as well, while Kamala Harris holds on to the three northern battleground states, including right here in Wisconsin. Scenario four, again, the least likely among these already unlikely scenarios, involves Trump carrying all the northern battleground states in Nevada, while Harris wins the three southern swing states. And again, I suspect that many of you are rightly saying, well, those kinds of things won't happen. Again, all of those are simply possibilities as we go forward and think about what could happen here. None of this completely anticipated, but could reach the result where both of them get 269 votes. We also have this situation where, of course, we've got electors. One of the things that we saw in 2016 is that five Democratic electors, two Republican electors, remember this, did not cast their votes for their party tickets, but instead voted for other candidates. That was back in 2016. This also assumes, of course, that all of these electors coming out of these states will be faithful to the results from their states. If you get what's called a faithless elector, that could change this dynamic as well. And the reason why all that is important is because we then turn to what? We turn to the United States Congress. 269 coming out of November 5th and maybe the days right after that. If the Congress finds an absence of a majority when it meets on January 6th of 2025, that's the date for the official counting of those electoral votes. And if at that time those envelopes, which we now know an awful lot about, if they're opened and the certification is that the Electoral College is a tie, 269-269, what happens? Well, we've got an answer to that. It turns out that the 12th Amendment to the Constitution, it is in our Constitution. And now we talk in this rule of law discussion about what that means, what it says. There are provisions for both the House and the United States Senate to make this decision. And we think then about what will happen here. The 12th Amendment calls for the House of Representatives to immediately, that's the word, choose the president from no more than the three candidates who won the most electoral votes. That's what the 12th Amendment says. In a 269-269 tie, that would mean that just the two major party nominees would be in play. Although, again, a faithless elector scenario could somehow affect that result, but unlikely once again, as all of this is to some extent. But the choice is not under our Constitution based merely on a simple vote of the House of Representatives and its members. You know well, the House is populated by what number of people? 435 representatives that we are electing again on November 5th. And it will be the new House, the House that's elected on November 5th, sworn in early January of 2025, that will then do this 12th Amendment review and analysis. It is decided not by members as a whole, not that everyone has a singular vote, and we figure out based upon that 435 division, again, right now, a very narrow majority for the Republicans. That's not how it's done under our Constitution. Instead, according to our 12th Amendment, decided another way. And we'll talk about that as we continue our discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review.
A new choice. Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
Lena Bloom for The Bail Project.
Imagine you're stuck in a jail cell and you can't afford bail and someone offers you a way out. Just plead guilty and you can go home and kiss your kids goodnight. What do you do? What thousands have. You plead guilty whether you are or not. Cash bail makes poverty a crime. That's why the Bail Project helps those who can't afford it while fighting to end cash bail. Because freedom should be free.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Christina Reynolds of Emily's List. Donald Trump had a quasi-town hall.
There were two questions, one on abortion and one on IVF. What he did was claim he just wanted the states to get to decide, and it is a lie. When they call it a national minimum standard, they are saying, we want the federal government to get to decide and not you.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Welcome to Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this, the second hour of our broadcast, talking about politics and partisan issues, but in the context of what would happen. What would happen under our Constitution if both of the principal candidates for the presidency, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, if neither one of them reaches the requisite number of 270 electoral votes, both of them tie at 269, highly unlikely that will happen, but possibility. Number of different scenarios out there that we talked about in our previous segment that raise the possibility if there's no decision based upon a clear winner, 270 votes, 269, 269, what does the 12th Amendment say? Well, with respect to the presidency, it is the House of Representatives then that would select a president of the United States of America. 435 members there. But significantly, the 12th Amendment does not contemplate simply a popular vote among them. Instead, the decision is made through a system whereby each state delegation casts one vote according to the preferences of each member inside that state's delegation. In other words, all the delegations get together individually. They choose among themselves, again, based upon partisan views and perspectives and allegiances there. And the states themselves vote as delegations inside the House of Representatives. And it may well be that if there are delegations where the Republicans and Democrats are split in congressional districts there, the delegation cannot reach a result, cannot reach a decision. Those delegations would be unable to cast a vote unless one member breaks with the party and votes for the other one. To win, a candidate, again, must win a majority of state delegations, and that number is 26, a second number here to keep in mind. You need 26 state delegations right now to win the presidency, not a majority of the 435, but 26 delegations. Again, voting by delegation. And currently, of course, as all of you can figure, regardless of your political focus and allegiance, currently right now, Republicans hold a majority of the House. In 26 of those states, 26 of those state delegations compared to 22 of the Democrats' delegations. Now, that can change, of course, based upon things that will happen again on January 5th. If anything, right now, an awful lot of people anticipate that the Republicans may control as many as 28 state delegations inside the House of Representatives. Democrats may drop to 18. That's not to say that the numbers overall would change hugely, but again, anticipating a continued Republican ownership and majority in the House could be as high as 28 delegations for the Republicans, maybe as low as 18. Even if it doesn't change at all right now, the calculus is 26
delegations in the House are Republican, 22 are the Democrats. And if, once again, those delegations vote as they predict, those delegations then select the next president. And likely under that scenario, which, again, lots of things have to happen here before any of this comes to pass. But under the 12th Amendment, those delegations vote. And if they vote right down party lines, Donald Trump is elected our next president because of the number of delegations inside the House of Representatives right now are majority Republican as opposed to Democrat. Again, all this premised upon a tie, 269-269, and then review by the House of Representatives. Fascinating stuff going on here right under the 12th Amendment. Is there precedent under this? Well, a little bit. There's one precedent. For a contingent election in 1824. 1824 was the last time that we looked at some of this. At that time, there was a party called the Democratic Republicans. They were known then as the Republicans, but they're unrelated to today's party. And they held a fairly dominant political position at the time. And that was in the midst of something called the Federalist Party's decline at the time. There were four separate Democratic Republicans who contested the presidential race at the time. And the number at that time that he had to get under the Electoral College was 131. 131 was the number out of 261. All right. But every contender fell short of that mark. Again, nobody reached that magic number of 261. Andrew Jackson won 99 electoral votes. Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, 84 electoral votes. Secretary of State William Crawford, 41 electoral votes. And House Speaker Henry Clay, remember him from history, came in fourth with 37. Nobody gets a majority coming out of the Electoral College. And when the House gathered in February of 1825 to choose a president again under the Constitution, it could only consider Jackson and Adams and Crawford. Those are the top three recipients of electoral votes under our constitutional regime. All were Democratic Republicans, and the party had internal divisions about how we go on this, and so eventually split into a new party system by the 1828 election, and that was history that resulted ultimately in Andrew Jackson's election, defeating Adams again in a head-to-head rematch 1828. But in 1824, 4 years before that, House members from the states that had supported Clay mostly shifted to Adams' camp when Clay decided to throw his support to Adams. And that enabled Adams to win the 13 additional states that he needed to attain the presidency. And the 12th Amendment came into play, and John Quincy Adams became the president over Andrew Jackson and the others. Jackson, again, 4 years later, goes on to win the presidency on an out-and-out vote. But it happened once before, 1824, when there was not a clear victor under the Electoral College. Again, fascinating to think about what may happen here. House of Representatives selecting our next president, if indeed there is a tie between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. What about the vice president? Where do we get a vice president if indeed the same happens there, a tie, 269-269 again? The Constitution gives us instruction on this. And we know, of course, the vice president is an important player in all of this, unlike the president when it comes to selecting a next president, because the vice president is also what? The vice president is the president of the Senate. We know that well because Kamala Harris and before her, Mike Pence running up to the Hill on a regular basis to break log jams when it comes to legislative votes happening in the Senate. It is the Senate under our Constitution that decides who fills the key position of the vice presidency if neither candidate, neither J.D. Vance nor Tim Walz, gets a majority in the Electoral College. If they also split 269-269, it is the House there. It is the Senate, unlike the House, that then makes the decision. And when we talk further, we'll talk about the possibilities inside a Senate vote with respect to the selection of a vice president under our Constitution as Amicus, a law review continues.
This is Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. 9 days until Election Day, Vice President Kamala Harris barnstorming the swing states. Today in Philadelphia, painting a picture of what happens if Donald Trump returns to the Oval Office.
It will be him sitting at that desk, stewing over his enemies list. He is full of grievance.
Former President Trump set to rally today in New York's Madison Square Garden. New York Republican Representative Elise Stefanik says Trump will help the Empire State secure GOP gains in Congress.
It was New York that flipped five seats that delivered the House Republican majority. We have made inroads in this state, and President Trump has led that effort. So I think we're going to have some surprises on election night when we see him overperform in New York.
One person has now died, says a hospital in Tel Aviv, with dozens of others reported hurt after a truck slammed into a bus stop near the Israeli city. It is being described as a possible terrorist attack and comes a day after Israel's retaliatory strike on Iran. This is ABC News.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Wisconsin falls to Penn State. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. College football, the Badgers losing at home to Penn State, 28-13. Wisconsin giving up a pick six. And backup, Bo Prabula, throwing a touchdown after Penn State quarterback Drew Aller left with a knee injury. Luke Fickell on Penn State's gadget plays on offense.
They did a pretty good job in the second half at being able to mix up on and cost us some issues. But we're still getting better. I mean, this is a team that's growing. We can't lose the confidence and the faith in the things that we do. And you know, skill set wise is a little bit different, but he proved that he can throw the football as well. And they make you play really honest, and they make you play incredibly disciplined. As the game wears on, sometimes those things wear at you. And that's where the execution in the second half, we weren't able to make the plays we needed to make. And in some ways, he did make those plays.
So the Badgers fall to 5-3 and are on the road against the Iowa Hawkeyes next week. NBA, the Bucks in New York tonight to take on the Brooklyn Nets. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. For your Sunday sunshine, highs in the lower 60s, a south wind up to 15 miles per hour, perhaps a little stronger. Tonight, increasing clouds, lows near 40. On Monday, we'll see mostly cloudy skies, breezy, and highs in the upper 60s. Currently 59 degrees.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds, which could be life-changing. I mean, you could put that money towards concert tickets for your daughter to see that singer who sings about painful breakups. And one song will inspire your little beauty to break up with that beast she's dating, Brian. Instead, she'll date someone who's nice and worthy of her love, not someone who addresses you and your spouse as, bro. And it's all because you could save money switching at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, not available in all states.
Have you heard? Compass is coming to Madison. What's that? Only the number one real estate brokerage in the country with cutting-edge marketing and global reach. Only one thing can make it better. The Aaron Weber Group. Well, it just got better. Still the same Aaron Weber Group, the guys you already know and trust, only now True North partners with Compass. With the Aaron Weber Group, you always had a guide. Now with Compass, you'll never miss a turn. The Aaron Weber Group, powered by Compass, at movetomadison.com.
Max Inc. on Civic Media with Mike and Wendy from Sunspot.
Can you imagine the mosh pit on the bridge that could happen?
Oh, well, that's how the original series was, when they moved the camera, whenever it's the red alert. That,
right.
Yeah. That was the mosh pit.
Yeah. And everybody had to, like, fake, like...
Right. Yeah, lean left. Great. Lean right.
Yeah.
Join us for all the fun with Max Inc. on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
The Todd Alba Show.
Matt Flynn joining us. This is a text off the text line. Quote, I'm dreading that it's a little too late. The last few weeks of polls are extremely bleak.
This is not the time to get wobbly. The polls right now still show her in the lead between 2 to 3 points. She used to be ahead by 5 points. So what?
Charles Franklin at Marquette Law School says polls don't vote. People do. Have a plan. Be a voter, Matt.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I'm joined by Ian Teal from the Wywiga Film Festival. And Deirdre and Stephen Starry drop by the studio to talk about the 125th anniversary of the Brown County Historical Society.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Jim Santel, your host of Amicus Law Review, as we continue to talk about the election and something that's fairly remote, unlikely to happen, but the possibility, given the closeness right now of the race between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris for the presidency, razor-thin leads, if any at all, in the seven so-called swing states, and even around the country, very, very close race. No one predicting with absolute clarity or certainty exactly what's going to happen here. Always the case until we collect and count all the votes, but especially in this election, an awful lot of predictions about how close this will be. If, in fact, it is as close as it can possibly be, some scenarios for both of the principal candidates to get not the requisite number of electoral votes, which is 270, but 269. And in that instance, in that unlikely but plausible possible circumstance, the presidency elected and selected by the House of Representatives based upon the number of delegations there. Almost certainly, if indeed it goes to the House as it did in 1824, almost certainly here, a Republican choice to place Donald Trump in the White House. And then what happens with respect to the vice presidency? Well, the 12th Amendment again divides this up, even though it's a unified ticket now. We go to the Senate to figure out who the vice president should be. And there, unlike the House, it's not based upon delegations, where, of course, you've got two senators from each state. There, unlike the House, a Senate contingent election vote would be based on a vote of the chamber as a whole. And by that, I mean in which each candidate needs 51 of 100 votes to win. It's a simple majority, 51 out of 100. And of course, we know right now that the Democrats hold a very, very narrow lead, 51 to 49 majority in the Senate. But the significance, of course, is all things can happen. Again, it's the new Senate that would select a vice president. We know that there are some very tight races in West Virginia, for example. We know that John Tester there in Montana is also facing a strong contest. You've got Sherrod Brown in Ohio. You've got other Democrats who are also defending their positions, including in Arizona and Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and yes, certainly right here in Wisconsin. All of those various results, and some of them closer than others. But again, depending upon what happens on November 5th and the days following, you could get a further change in the math and the composition of the United States Senate. Right now, Democrats 51 to 49. And that is significant, of course, because if the Senate remains exactly as it is and everyone votes according to their political party, there are actually four independents inside the Senate. They tend to caucus with the Democrats. And so if you add their numbers in, then you might get the selection of a Democratic candidate for the vice presidency. That, of course, would be Tim Walz. An interesting result if indeed you elect a vice president in the Democratic ticket and the House elects a Republican candidate. Unlikely, once again, something like that would happen. But once again, it is dependent upon a vote inside the United States Senate. Contingent election based upon who gets 51 or more votes in the United States Senate. An awful lot of that, of course, depending upon who we send to the United States Senate across the country in this coming election. As we know, a lot of those seats are contested. So once again, all of these things a part of our Constitution. And that being said, of course, there are the possibilities of some unexpected delays in the House's process. If the House fails, for example, to elect a president, if for some reason that doesn't happen by Inauguration Day, which is January 20th of 2025, the Senate's choice for vice president would serve as an acting president until the House elects a president. Fascinating, right? And if the Senate also fails to elect a vice president, according to its constitutional mandate, the Presidential Succession Act, this is legislation, calls for the Speaker of the House to be next in line to serve as an acting president. And assuming that individual, of course, right now it's Mike Johnson, meets the presidential eligibility requirements and that the House is able to select one, that hasn't easily happened in recent times, of course. But all of those things contingent upon many, many possibilities, all of that quite unlikely. But nonetheless, that's what our Constitution says. We've got selection by the House of the President. We've got selection by the Senate of the Vice President, if indeed the Electoral College does not produce a clear winner. 270 is that magic number we're all looking to. The 1824, 1825 example showing that this does, in fact, raise the possibility under our Constitution of a congressional decision about who our leadership is. Unlikely in this election, but a possibility. And the law is still there. The Constitution still requires that a decision is made in that way. Fascinating to think about. Again, something we wouldn't discuss absent, number one, your good questions and your good inquiries about what this 12th Amendment says, voiced here on Amicus Law Review, and also animating the other issue that we're going to talk about now in this, our final segments here on Amicus Law Review, and that is, what can Donald Trump do when it comes to the Department of Justice? We know once again that the United States Supreme Court has stunningly said, as of July 1, changing the Constitution, that a president is now completely immune from criminal prosecution, can't touch him or her for engagements with, communications with, things involving directives to the Attorney General and the United States Department of Justice. That longstanding understanding, including what happened with Richard Nixon, that indeed you can't suborn perjury, you can't obstruct justice, you can't do things with respect to the Department of Justice that are contrary to the law, that has been upended. And the Supreme Court now says that presidents get complete passes when it comes to engagements with the Department of Justice. It makes important Donald Trump's repeated statements in the public domain, not interpretations of what he has said, but out-and-out talks, out-and-out calls for retribution against his political rivals and others. He routinely calls for prosecuting his current opponent, that's Vice President Kamala Harris. He talks about prosecuting the current president, Joe Biden, and, of course, others in the cabinet. And he has charged the Biden administration with weaponizing the Justice Department against him. And he has said that when he becomes the president of the United States of America, these are his words, not mine, not an interpretation, he will similarly use the Department of Justice to jail rivals, to weaponize his Department of Justice in the same way that he feels, without justification, without factual predicate, but he feels the Justice Department has been weaponized against him. This is payback time, according to Donald Trump. And the question you have raised is whether he could do that kind of thing. What about the Department of Justice? What about its constitution, its structure, its analysis, the way that it functions? Can he, in fact, do those kinds of things? It raises questions about what kinds of restraints are there right now that could prevent him from following through. And since Watergate, of course, we know the presidency of Richard Nixon, followed by the presidency of Gerald Ford, Richard Nixon resigned under threat of impeachment for meddling with an FBI investigation, for doing exactly what the Supreme Court has now said a president can do. American presidents have taken pains until July 1 and through today. Joe Biden is not exercising any of the authorities that the Supreme Court has given to him appropriately. He is not committing crimes in the office. He is not exercising duties and responsibilities beyond what the Constitution and the laws of this country say, but a future president could. And the question is, with that kind of an immunity grant, what about this traditional relationship between the White House and the Department of Justice? Talked about a lot in this broadcast, this arm's length notion that while the Attorney General is indeed a member of the cabinet, still, you do not want Republican administrations, Democratic administrations, you do not want a presidency, a White House that is directing the day-to-day activities of the Department of Justice. You want an independent, admittedly with a small eye, an independent Department of Justice that can make determinations not based on politics or partisan views or even animus about political rivals, but based upon what? The facts and the law. That's what the Justice Department does. That's why it's so important to elect a president who appoints an attorney general, appoints U.S. attorneys who understand that nonpartisan, apolitical commission given to them. That's why this is all important. And that's why our tradition has been arm's length. Talked a lot about the fact that Janet Reno, with whom I had the great honor to work for about 2 years when she was our attorney general, did not get along with Bill Clinton
and did many things that he did not like, and I would offer at the time and offer to this day that that kind of relationship is a good thing because it places them at arm's length from each other and ensures the integrity of a Department of Justice that is not directed by the whims and the political animus, if you will, of a president. And so that tradition, which has lasted for the most part until the previous Trump administration, when we know that Donald Trump began to break down some of those barriers, directing at his attorney general, dismiss certain cases, for example, Michael Flynn, other things involving some of his allies of the president. We know that that began to fall apart. In a second term, Donald Trump has promised that those guardrails will come apart. And the question is whether that could happen. Let's talk about what the Department of Justice is all about. Plainly, if reelected, Donald Trump does have the prerogative to appoint an attorney general. And how does that process work? Well, he names that attorney general probably even after he is elected. And that can happen. The nominating process can go forward. And the review of a nominee could be considered by the Congress even before the new Congress takes office. They're the ones who are going to be deciding on it. But a lot of review and analysis in the public domain, that will be the subject of a lot of focus. Who is the president's cabinet between November and January? And Congress can begin to take some of that up, even though they vote on that. The advise and consent portion of our Constitution says presidents nominate and the Senate confirms. And that's why, once again, not only is the presidency at play, but also, as you know well, a third of the Senate. It makes a difference who we send to the Senate because, again, senators are the ones who conduct hearings with respect to all of the cabinet secretaries, including the attorney general herself or himself. And they can, in fact, and they have from time to time, as you know well, decide in their advise and consent capacity not to confirm a president. If the Republicans have a command of the Senate, likely they will confirm the attorney general, whoever that is that the president may select. If the Democrats have the command of the United States Senate, likely that they will at least give some pushback on that, depending upon who the candidate is. That advice and consent process is one of the guardrails that's out there in our Constitution that would prevent a president from placing in office, not just for the attorney general, but for all those other positions that I've talked about in this broadcast and others. The deputy attorney general, the second in command, the associate attorney general, responsible for many things involving civil litigation, including that case coming out of Baltimore and the ship there. The assistant attorneys general in all sorts of categories for environment and tax and criminal and civil and antitrust and national security, a great number of those, all of those also appointed by the president, identified by the president. And again, he has indicated, Donald Trump has indicated, that he will make those appointments based upon loyalty to him. His words, not mine. And of course, all of them subject to confirmation by the Senate. That's the guardrail on that. But it would give him, again, assuming that those people that he nominates are confirmed by the Senate in one way or another, would give him control over a vast machinery of the criminal process and also the civil process inside the Department of Justice. One of those most important appointments, of course, and the authority inside the Department of Justice is the FBI director himself. Ordinarily serves a 10-year term. Right now we know that Christopher Wray encumbers that position. But a president could, in fact, fire an FBI director. We know well that Donald Trump, during his first term, fired Wray's predecessor. His name is James Comey. He did that in 2017 and could nominate and could appoint a new FBI director. Again, not without advice and consent, but nonetheless has authority to establish inside the Department of Justice some greater authorities there. He also has, of course, the responsibility, the obligation to appoint 93 United States attorneys around the country, assistant attorneys general, all those kinds of people who enforce the federal law. And that includes criminal cases, civil cases, great authority in districts around the country. As we continue, we'll talk more about this question about inside the Department of Justice and what can be done by a future president.
A voice for Madison. Real news and great conversation. 92.7 WMDX.
Come to the Lazy Elf Lounge to cheer on the green and gold. Enjoy free Jello shots with every Green Bay touchdown. Stock up on $20 buckets of White Claw and High Noon, $15 assorted buckets of Busch Light, Miller, and Bud products, plus $4 off wing baskets when you dine in. Come for all the fun on game days at the Lazy Elf Lounge, North Stoughton Road in Madison. Follow them on Facebook and find the full menu at LazyElfLounge.com.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Donald Trump was in the great state of Michigan, my birth state, and he insulted Detroit.
Our whole country will end up being like Detroit if she's your president.
You're in Detroit, man! I would tell you, sir, we would only be so lucky if we had the mentality of people trying to do better for their cities, for small businesses moving in. There's a renaissance going on in the city of Detroit.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app. A new choice. Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review as we are continuing our discussion here about what's inside the Department of Justice and what kinds of things under the laws and structures there could prevent or also facilitate a decision by a president, including Donald Trump, to restructure not only how the Department of Justice works with respect to the independence from the White House, but also pursuing what he has promised to do, which is pursue his rivals. So we know, indeed, that the president has this huge appointment power. Attorney general, deputy attorney general, United States attorneys around the country, all of them have to be confirmed by the Senate. And that is a significant stopgap. That's a significant standard that also applies. And indeed, a Senate could, in fact, decide not to confirm some of those nominees, maybe forcing some more moderate choices or some other people that are more amenable to what a majority of the senators would like to see in those positions. But there's also a limit to that, because Trump could also use the vacancies that would be created early in his term under some specific procedures that are also a part of this. Fascinating to think about this as well. He could use the vacancies to fill the department's top ranks without Senate confirmation for up to 300 days at the start of his administration. He would be limited in making these appointments to a pool of senior Justice Department employees and Senate-confirmed officials. In other words, they've got to be in place already, have to be Senate-confirmed. But for 300 days, he could identify and appoint them to some of these positions if indeed the United States Senate is balking and saying, no, we won't want to go along with your appointees. And those appointees for 300 days could change dramatically. This relationship between the department and the House and the White House itself, preventing some of these partisan things from being in place, the partisan directives that say that there should not be a connection between the White House, depending upon who the president would appoint and how that works, that could also affect criminal investigations. And this gets us back to the central question that some of you have raised, and that is that unfettered communication, whether it's under a 300-day period or a broader period of time, under these circumstances, it depends upon who you put in all these positions, right? When it comes to the conduct of criminal investigations, what are the standards there? Well, again, as we've talked at great length in the past, one of those standards is facts
and the law. Those are the two principal things that animate investigations. Everybody, civil servants, should be guided by that, and political appointees as well. That's the premise upon which our Department of Justice works. Interestingly, Donald Trump has also contemplated in that connection a complete overhaul, and he could issue an executive order removing civil servant protections so that the attorney general could fire thousands of nonpartisan career lawyers and FBI agents. That is a stunning thing to think about. It is a part of what has been discussed out there in the public domain. And indeed, in the last hours and days of his administration, way back in 2021, he did, in fact, issue an order. It was known as Schedule F. It's also now a part of this thing called Project 2025. It's also a part of what has been advocated for by this other group that we will talk about briefly today called the America First Policy Institute. And they're advocating, again, the reinitiation, the resurrection of Schedule F, because when Joe Biden became president, he rescinded that. It never happened. But it's a blueprint for basically changing the way that civil servants work throughout the government, including in the United States Department of Justice. And so this combination between appointing people who may be loyal to you, getting Senate confirmation or even not getting it for 300 days, changing the ways in which civil servants who are committed to doing things in nonpartisan ways, apolitically, the combination of all of those things provide some guardrails, some standards, but not a lot. Not a lot. And under the right circumstances, Donald Trump could, in fact, at least initiate, if he's got the right people who are loyal to him and who want to turn their back somewhat upon the commissions given to them to observe the law and the facts, could open investigations or at least influence investigations of a criminal nature. And that gets us back to the allegation or the claim again that Donald Trump wants to pursue criminal investigations of his political rivals. The Trump-appointed attorney general could tap someone in the criminal division, maybe a special counsel, maybe mainline civil servants loyal to the president to pursue those investigations. And as is often said, the process could be the punishment, even if in the end those investigations do not result in an indictment by a criminal grand jury, which, again, another standard, another stopgap on prosecutions of people for political purposes. And even if you do get U.S. attorneys out there, the process in many ways of simply initiating investigations that are without merit, if that is accomplished by Trump loyalists inside the Department of Justice, appointed by Donald Trump, maybe arguably confirmed by United States Senate or not during a 300-day period, the prospect of investigations being initiated, even if they're not consummated, even if they're not brought to conclusion, that is concerning enough. And as I said, the process is often the punishment when it comes to investigations. That's the specter. And that's the reason why all of this is a source of great concern. Next time, we're going to talk more about other aspects of this, including the Inspector General, which also provides a stopgap. We're going to talk more about the pardon power that's out there and other restrictions on the limits of a president to use the Department of Justice, even in the wake of the decision by the Supreme Court to grant him great, great authorities. We will also continue and really initiate our discussion about this other entity out there that's advocating some of these same kinds of things. It's a group called the America First Policy Institute, with little fanfare and not quite as much scrutiny as Project 2025, advancing many of these same kinds of principles in a policy book called the America First Agenda. We're going to talk more about that. We're going to talk more about the consequences of a Trump presidency with respect to the Department of Justice, with respect to the rule of law, with respect to courts in America in our next iteration of Amicus, a Law Review. Join me for that next weekend as well. Have a good weekend.
Welcome to Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time as we start our What Makes Wisconsin Great tour with Trigby Olson of the Lincoln Project and Reed Galen of the Union. Get on the road with us next time.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
We visited Alexandria, Minnesota a few summers ago. Great time, lakes, fishing, all that. But this year, for the holidays, we wanted a winter vacation that was just as memorable, just as family-friendly, but with lights and snow, and this time with our grandkids in tow. This holiday, it's Alexandria again. We're coming back to make new memories.
Explore your holiday getaway options at explorealex.com.
Enjoying this local program?
Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
This is 92.7 WMDX Columbus, Madison's home for real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.